quickly. Chapter 1. We've been in the study of Mark. We began with Jesus' ministry beginning at his baptism. That was when Jesus actually officially started the work of redemption that he was going to complete in his lifetime. He's baptized by John in the Jordan River. Then he goes and he casts out an unclean spirit in a man. He calls Andrew, Peter, James, and John to follow him in chapter 1. He heals Peter's mother-in-law in chapter 1. He heals many with diseases and casts out many devils. Then it tells us about the man with the leprosy. He cured the man with leprosy. And because of these things, his fame had begun to grow and his notoriety became greater as time goes on, based on what his teaching, because he taught them as someone who had authority, not like the scribes and Pharisees. Plus, he was doing all these miracles. And so, as you think about these things, people were witnessing these things with Jesus, but his fame not only was in the area of Galilee, but it had begun to spread throughout Israel, and even probably beyond that, because Israel had a lot of seaports, and so sailors were coming in and going out, and anybody that does the signs Jesus did would have been somebody people talked about. So at the beginning of chapter 2, you have Jesus going into Capernaum, where he's teaching. He heals a man of palsy, a man that was brought to him because the crowd was so heavy, they let him down through the roof. And Jesus healed the man by just simply telling him, "Son, thy sins are forgiven thee." That caused tremendous heartburn for the scribes and Pharisees there, because they reasoned in their heart, only God can forgive sins. So that's the animosity, if you will, has begun to build within the Pharisees and the scribes against Jesus, even at a fairly early age. 2:14, we find Jesus calling Levi, the son of Alphaeus, to follow him. In the same way, in the same manner, he called Peter, James, John, and Andrew. Now, who is Levi? Who do we know him by? He's Matthew. He's the apostle Matthew, is who Levi was, and he was a tax collector. Now, what do you know about what happened when Jesus called Peter, James, John, Andrew, and Matthew? What did they have as a characteristic of their call? Their response. What did they do? That's exactly right. They stopped doing what they were doing. They left their nets as fishermen. Matthew left his table of tax collecting. They gave up their occupations. They gave up their life, if you will, to go and follow Jesus. That was characteristic of all these men that Jesus are going to call. They were expected to basically surrender themselves to be a disciple of Jesus and to be trained by him. So then Matthew invites Jesus to his house to have a meal. Now, Matthew, being a tax collector, would have been considered what in the eyes of the Jews? Well, he'd been a publican. That's what publicans were. They were tax collectors. They were people who worked for the Roman government in some capacity, and they were basically ostracized by the Jewish hierarchy particularly, but by the Jewish nation. They kind of got looked down upon because they were supporting, if you will, the Romans. And so Matthew would have been fairly well paid, and so as a tax collector, he had probably more wealth than certainly Peter and James and John would have had. And so he has this house, and he invites Jesus to the meal and a whole bunch of publicans and sinners. When it says publicans and sinners, they're talking about from a Pharisee's point of view. A Pharisee saw tax collectors and people who worked for the Romans as publicans. Sinners were who? All the people that weren't Pharisees. Just a common old man out on the street would have been considered a sinner. So they had this elitist attitude, if you will, that they were somehow above the fray. You remember when you had the Pharisee and the publican go in to pray? What did the Pharisee pray? I thank thee, Lord, I'm not like that man. That's the attitude that the Pharisees pretty much had in their looking at and viewing the Jewish people in general. Most of them perceived the Jewish people as being unlearned, unskilled, uneducated, and not understanding the law. They need to be told by the Pharisees what they are to think and do. So in verse 15, it said, it came to pass that as Jesus sat at meat in his house, that's Matthew's house, many publicans and sinners sat also together with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many and they followed him. So Matthew and the other friends he had, which would have been tax collectors and so forth, they all came to his house and had a meal with Jesus. Now, the reaction of the Pharisees and scribes to this event is notable. In verse 16 and 17, it says, and when the scribes and Pharisees saw him sit it with the publicans and sinners, they said to his disciples, how is it that he eats and drinks with publicans and sinners? That's because they didn't associate with publicans and sinners. They saw themselves as being above that. Those people, they wouldn't just call them unclean, but they were the downtrodden, if you will, not someone that you would socialize with. And when Jesus hears it, he said to them, they that are whole have no need of a physician, but they that are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. That is a classic case of sarcasm, if you ever heard it. And the scribes and Pharisees would not have missed the point. What's Jesus actually saying? What's he saying to these people? You think you're righteous. Okay, well, that's all right. They were self-righteous. But what Jesus said was, I'm not here to call the righteous folks. You guys, I'm here to call sinners, which, of course, all men are. So what was the problem the scribes and the Pharisees had? What was causing them to be so upset with Jesus? They were jealous. Jealous of what? He was teaching with authority. He had a command of the old law that was unparalleled in their cases. And so they were supposed to be the rabbis. They're the ones that teach the law. And here this man is who was what? A carpenter's son. He would have been one of those people that are considered sinners. He wasn't an educated man. He wasn't one of the elite, if you will. And yet here he was, not only teaching with authority, but he was gaining notoriety. People were listening and being amazed at what he was saying to them. Now, as we go through the book of Mark, one of the things I want you to pay attention to, we learn about the life of Jesus Christ in the book of Mark. We do. But there's an undercurrent of something we need to also grasp, and that is the attitude of the scribes and Pharisees, the attitude of men, because it's not just the scribes and Pharisees of that day that had this problem. This attitude of jealousy, of being angry because you're not being included in the group, and that's, Jesus didn't run with the scribes and the Pharisees. He went with just the common folks. The Pharisees, you know, if he'd gone to the Pharisees' house and sitting at a meal, they'd all been perfectly happy. Rabbi! But Jesus didn't give them that kind of respect that they thought they deserved. He was talking to the common folks. And so they were really irate because by what Jesus did in his life, condemned them for their attitude about the people. When people do good, people who don't do good typically have the same reaction these people had. And so they were the anger you can see is beginning to fester already. And even as Jesus exposes their self-righteous, hypocritical attitude, instead of understanding what he said about I've come to call sinners and understanding that, well, all men are sinners, they double down. They do not want to accept what he's saying as applying to them. So in verse 18 it says, why do the disciples of John and of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples fast not? What they're doing is kind of an underhanded criticism, if you will. Y'all are not all that much. After all, the Pharisees fast. John the Baptist's disciples are fasting. What were they inferring by fasting?
Self-control.
Ma'am? That they, yeah, that they were righteous. They were God's people. They were the holy ones, if you will. And so they criticized Jesus because his disciples are not fasting. Now, a few months ago, I had a person ask me about fasting. And so since we're talking about fasting, I thought I'd take just a second and talk about fasting. Should Christians fast today? Well, first place, we need to understand what fasting is. What is fasting? Well, it's setting aside a period of time where you neither eat nor drink. You devote yourself to prayer. So should Christians fast today? Well, we know it was a very common practice in the first century. John's disciples fasted. The Pharisees fasted. In fact, Jesus teaches there's a correct way and an incorrect way to fast. If you look in Matthew chapter 6, it says, moreover, when you fast, be not as the hypocrites, of a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces, that they may appear to men to fast. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. But you, when you fast, anoint your head, wash your face, that you appear not unto men to fast, but unto your Father which is in secret. And your Father which sees in secret shall reward you openly. And so fasting should not be something just to gain notoriety and praise. Remember the Pharisees? She said they loved to stand in the marketplace and have long flowing prayers. Why? Well, because they wanted to praise the men. When it says that they disfigured their face, they made it clear that they were suffering under this fast. Look how holy we are. Jesus says they got the reward. They got patted on the back. But it did zero as far as God was concerned. So when did God's people fast? Well, we have numerous examples in Scripture of people that fasted. Esther, before she went in to see the king, which by not being invited could have been a death sentence, told Mordecai, her uncle, to get all the Jews in the city and fast for 3 days and pray that when I go before the king, I'm not executed. Then you had Moses. He fasted 40 days on the mountain while he was receiving the law. Then you had Jesus. Went into the desert for 40 days. He fasted. What was Jesus doing while he was fasting? Throwing rocks in the pond? Strolling around smelling the flowers? No, he was in prayer. He was fisting to start a ministry of profound importance for all the world. And so he spent 40 days in prayer to God, asking for strength, asking for guidance, You had Daniel. He fasted for 3 weeks before he had his vision, making supplication to God, not only for his sins, but for the sins of the people. You had David. He fasted for almost 7 days, I think it was, pleading for his son's life that him and Bathsheba had. Then you had Saul of Tarsus. He fasted for 3 days, neither eating nor drinking, waiting for God's messenger to come, because Jesus said, go, someone will tell you what you needed to do. What do you think Paul was doing? He was praying. He was devoutly devoted his whole heart and mind to his plight, understanding his condition, because he knew what he had been doing to Jesus. He now understood who Jesus was. There is a man who was in serious prayer to God, and he fasted. When you fast, you don't take out time for the carnal things of the flesh. 2 Corinthians, Paul, in talking about all his troubles, he says, in weariness and painfulness, in watchings, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and in nakedness. Paul fasted multiple times. Why? Because he was in distress multiple times. 1 Corinthians 7, it says, default you not one to the other. This is talking about husband and wives not giving up the fleshly needs of their flesh. It says that except you get consent between your partner and then just for a time. Why? That you may give yourself to fasting and prayer. Fasting is always associated with and tied to prayer. Verse 6, it says, but I speak by permission, not by commandment. So should we fast? Can we fast? Yes. Should we fast? That's an individual thing. You have permission to, but you're not commanded to. But fasting, like vowing, is a very serious matter. It can bring blessings, but if you abandon your fast, it's the same as not fulfilling your vow, that brings condemnation. And so in Solomon, in Ecclesiastes, he said, be not hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, you're upon earth. Therefore, let your speech be limited. You've got to be careful. Because when you say, I'm going to fast for a week, and you start getting hungry, and you decide, you know, that's 3 days is enough. God's not going to be happy if you violate your commitment. So you need to be careful not to, you know, Ecclesiastes says, do not vow unless you intend to keep the vow. And in a way, fasting is a vow. You have determined. It's not something you just do the day because you just didn't think about it. A fast is something that you predetermine the bounds of and the limits of. And you do that because of your desire to be closer to God. And that's what fasting does. It brings one closer to God, especially in time of need, stress, sorrow, or uncertainty. A person who's looking for a job would be perfectly acceptable for them to go 3 or 4 days without eating or drinking, praying to God for a job. Nothing at all would be inappropriate about that. It's also a way of demonstrating to yourself, and this is a crucial point, folks, it's a way to demonstrate to yourself that you are a spiritual being, not controlled by the flesh. You, in a way, when Paul said he buffeted his body, that's fasting. Where you deprive your body of food and water, which it desires to have, so you can give yourself to the spiritual things that are really important. You teach yourself and your flesh that there's more important things in life than eating Jesus said, "A man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." And so fasting is something which we have the privilege of doing, but we need to do it correctly. We need to have the right attitude of heart. Yeah. This weather, folks, my sinuses just don't agree. So bear with me. So back to the text. Verse 18, we find the Pharisees complaining to Jesus about his disciples not fasting. And Jesus tells them in verse 19's beginning, it says, "And Jesus said to them, 'Can the children of the bride chamber fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken away from them, and then shall they fast in those days.'" In this verse 20, Jesus is acting as a prophet of God and making a forecast or a prophecy. The days are coming. What days are coming? Well, the day of his death. The day's coming when I'll be taken away. I'll be departing this world. I'll be leaving these disciples behind. Then they will fast. He continues with his prophesying. In verse 21 and 22, he says, "No man also sews a piece of new cloth on an old garment, as the new piece that fills up takes away from the old, and the tear is made worse. And no man puts new wine into old bottles, lest the new wine does burst the bottles, and the wine is spilled, and the bottles be marred. But new wine must be put in new bottles." So what's Jesus talking about? What is he prophesying about? Jeremiah 31:31 says what? "The days are coming when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel. Not like the covenant I made with their fathers when I took them by the hand and led them out of Egypt." Hebrews 10:9 says, "He takes away the first that he may establish the second." So people who want to take part of the old law and bring it and put it in the new law fail to appreciate what Jesus is teaching here. No man does that because it doesn't work. You can't put a patch in an old garment. You can't put new wine in old bottles. The old law was done away with because the new law was brought into its existence. And so Jesus is here again prophesying about that which is going to take place in the future. They still got the old garment now. That's the old law. But the days are coming when he'll leave and when there'll be a new law. And then we find Jesus passing through a cornfield on the Sabbath, and his disciples are picking some ears of corn. Now, a lot of translations say passing through a grain field, and they pick a head of grain. People get hung up on incidental. It doesn't make any difference. That's not the issue. The issue is that the Pharisees are trying to find fault. And so they say to Jesus, "Behold, why do they do on the Sabbath that which is not lawful?" Now, I want you to notice some things here, because there's a lot of things that sometimes you read past them and don't grasp. What does that verse say about this situation that you wouldn't necessarily think about? It says, "Your disciples are passing through the grain field and picking handfuls of grain and eating." What is not said?
You're not washing your hands.
No. It doesn't say Jesus picked any grain. You notice that? The disciples are picking grain, but not Jesus. Was it lawful for them to pick grain on the Sabbath day and eat? In the book of Numbers, you had a man picking up a few sticks, and God said, "Take that man out of the camp and stone him to death." You're not allowed to do any work, and picking up a few sticks wouldn't be considered work by us, but activity that was lending itself to preparing for something during your day was considered work. You had to rest. And so was it lawful for them to take the grain? Not really. But Jesus turns it around on them. He says, look what it says in 25. And Jesus said unto them, have you not read? David and his men, being hungry, went into the temple, into the tabernacle, and took the showbread, and did eat, which was only for the priest. Now what's Jesus saying? That what David did was right? It was all right for David to take the showbread? No, it wasn't right for David to take the showbread. It was for the priest. Neither was it right for them to eat the grains of corn, because it was a Sabbath. But Jesus points to their hypocrisy. They had no problem with David, which is much more serious offense than them picking a handful of grain. The Jews didn't, David's a hero. Jesus is pointing out the hypocrisy of these people. Their complaining wasn't because they really were concerned about these men eating grain or not eating grain. They were just nitpicking anything they could find to find fault with Jesus Christ. Look what it says in Luke. Which of you shall have a donkey or an ox fall into a pit and will not straightway pull it out on the Sabbath day? They knew they would do that. Now, I don't know how many of y'all have ever pulled an animal out of a ditch, but I have. That's hard work. You don't get a horse out of a ditch without some help. You have to work. And yet they did that on the Sabbath day without any problem with breaking the Sabbath. And yet you're going to squabble? You see, what he's pointing to is not that what the disciples did was, he wasn't talking about the disciples eating grain, not eating. He's talking about the attitude of the heart of the people who brought the accusations. They didn't care. It's like, well, I won't even go there. I won't go there. We're going to go right on. Matthew 27, well, Mark 2, verse 27, he said, the Sabbath was made for man, and man not for the Sabbath. Therefore the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. So what he's doing to these Pharisees is he's reminding them of the truth that he's already established. In chapter 1, he's already said that the Son of Man had the authority to forgive sins. Now what he's saying is the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. That means he's master of the Sabbath. Jesus can set aside any law he chose to set aside. The forgiveness of sins was God's prerogative. Setting aside the Sabbath day for his disciples was Jesus' prerogative. They didn't do anything wrong because the Lord Jesus, who is Lord of the Sabbath, permitted it. Now let's look at the term Son of Man. That phrase is used 14 times in Mark. Jesus refers to himself 80 some odd times in the Gospels as the Son of Man. 8 times in the New Testament writers. So 88 times Jesus referred to as the Son of Man. Now, when I say Jesus Christ, every single one of you immediately think in your heart and mind, the Son of God, and he certainly is the Son of God. No doubt whatsoever. But he's also the Son of Man. Jake is the son of Si. No doubt. But he's also the son of Becky. Equally, Becky's son as Si's son. Jesus is both God and man. Now that's a thing that's, we're not really going to be able to really truly comprehend all that's involved with that. But we know that Jesus focused on being a son of man while he was in the earth in his ministry. He emphasized the role. As man, he was a servant. And that's how he preferred to refer to himself, as the Son of Man. Mark 10, verse 45, "For even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many." Philippians 2, Paul writes, "But made of himself, Jesus Christ, of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of man. And being found in the fashion of a man, he humbled himself, and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross." What did Jesus tell the man he cured of leprosy? "Don't tell nobody that I cured you." He wasn't looking for fame. He wasn't looking for notoriety. Now it came, and it came rightfully so, but it wasn't because Jesus was doing these things to promote himself. He made of himself no reputation. And as Stephen was dying on that fretful day, he looked up into heaven and said, "Behold, I see the heavens opened, and the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God." Stephen said, "I see the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God." It was Jesus of Nazareth that went to the cross. It was Jesus of Nazareth that was placed in the tomb. It was Jesus of Nazareth that arose and ascended into heaven. It is Jesus of Nazareth that sits at the right hand of God. Romans 5:12 says, "Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression, who is the figure of him that was to come. But not as the offense, so also is the free gift. For if through the offense of one man many be dead, much more the grace of God and the gift of by grace, which is by one man, Jesus Christ, hath abounded in the many. And not as it was that one that not as it was by one that sinned, so is the gift. But the judgment was by one to condemnation, but the free gift is of many offenses unto justification. Therefore, as by the offense of one man, judgment came upon all men to condemnation, even so by the righteousness of one man, the free gift came upon all men unto justification. Jesus Christ, in his role as Redeemer and Savior, did that as a man. Jesus came in the form of man. Back in Genesis, who was it that sinned? Man. What was required was a sacrifice by a man to undo what was done. And therefore God, because no man is perfect, sent his own Son in the likeness of man to be man and be sin for us. That's all of chapter 2. Any questions about anything we've discussed up to this point? Okay, I'll take your solace to mean I did a really good job. Things that we're going to be looking at in chapter 3. First, you have Jesus' fame is steadily growing as he taught the people and did many miracles in the surrounding areas of Capernaum. As a result, multitudes are coming out to see Jesus from Galilee, Judea, Jerusalem, Emmaus, beyond Jordan, from as far away as Tyre and Sidon. And so if you look at the map, Tyre and Sidon is at the very top. Jerusalem is down toward the bottom. All of Israel was coming out to witness Jesus and listen to his teachings. We'll look at how Jesus selects 12 men to be his apostles. We'll see how Jesus further angers the Pharisees by healing on the Sabbath, and how they conspire with the Herodians to try and destroy Jesus. Chapter 3 talks about his friends and family failing to believe in him. Remember, a prophet has no honor in his own land, his own city. Jesus is accused of working by the power of Beelzebub. Jesus' family finally will come. Mary, it says, your mother and your brethren are here to speak to you. That's the end of chapter 3. So chapter 3, verse 1 and 2. And he entered again into the synagogues, and there was a man which had a withered hand. And they, they're talking about Pharisees, scribes and Pharisees, and they watched him, whether he would heal on the Sabbath, that they might accuse him. So here they are, we're waiting to pounce. Here's a man on the Sabbath has a withered hand. Jesus is noticeably frustrated with these Pharisees. Why was Jesus noticeably frustrated?
They're so focused on accusing him
that they would rather a man be. There you go. They had no compassion at all for the man. All they really want to do is try to trip Jesus up, if you will. And Jesus was frustrated. In fact, the very next verse says, and he said to them, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath day or to do evil, to save life or to kill? But they held their peace. What Jesus did is he diffused their claim. He asked them a simple question. Is it right to do good on the Sabbath or to do evil? The question itself infers the answer. Well, certainly it's good to do things on the Sabbath. And so by asking the question, Jesus takes away their ability to criticize him because they had an opportunity to answer. No, you can't do good on the Sabbath. But of course, you can't do that. That would have been illogical. And when he had looked around about on them in anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts, he said unto the man with the withered hand, stretch forth thy hand. Is it sinful to be angry?
No.
No, it is not. We ought to be angry when we see injustice, when we see evil. But the difference between angry and having hatred. You don't have hatred toward somebody. You can get angry because their conduct. A father can get angry with his son because he does something against a knothead. But that's not the same as getting hatred. We should get angry. The scripture says, be angry, but sin not. So Jesus says, stretch out thy hand. And he stretched it out, and the hand was restored whole as the other. The Pharisees, of course, were livid. I mean, they were waiting to accuse him, but now they can't accuse him because they've already been asked the question, was it right to do good? And they didn't say, no, it wasn't. And so they can't do anything about complaining against him. And so they're angry. Their anger festers. The Pharisees went out and straightway took counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. So now you see for the first time where they actually begin to look ways to destroy Jesus. Now they haven't got to the point yet where they're thinking about killing him, but they're trying their best to destroy him. And they'll do that with a multitude of temptations. They'll have the lawyers come and question him. They'll try to bring the woman, talk to the adultery. They'll do all sorts of things to try to trip him up. But their heart is set on doing just that. We see the festering hatred, jealousy, and irrational anger of the Pharisees and self-righteous Jews. It's irrational to be angry at a man who just healed a man with a crippled arm. It's irrational to be angry with a man that just cast an unclean spirit out of a person. But when you're jealous and you have hatred in your heart, it leads to that very thing. Look at Genesis. This isn't new. But unto Cain, God had no offering. He had no respect. But Cain was very angry or wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, why are you angry? Why does your countenance fall? If you do well, shall it not be accepted? If you do wrong, you do evil, sin lies at the door. Cain's had an irrational anger. Who was he angry with? Abel. Why? Abel hadn't done anything. You see, when people fall into this snare of jealousy, they fall into a sphere of hatred, then their logic goes away. They get blinded. And so they come up with just completely irrational and stupid things. There was a man the other day, 2 hours after Charlie Kirk was killed, who talked about how it was his fault he got killed. That's irrational. That's the way the world is and how it deals with issues. When you cannot overcome with sound logic and arguments of justification for points, then you just strike out. That's what man does. That's what the Pharisees were doing. That's what people today do. And our time is up. We will pick up in chapter 3 on the 19th of October. I appreciate your time.